guarding and protecting the owner in his rights. But then Tawney went further yet and made infamous history with an opinion proclaiming that blacks had for more than a century been regarded as beings of an inferior order, so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. To anti-slavery Northerners, the idea of a slave power conspiracy had never seemed so evident. In the wake of Dred Scott versus Sanford, shockwaves spread across American society like nothing before it in the long story of the slavery debate. Most white Southerners could not have been more delighted by a decision of the High Court confirming their long-argued claim of state sovereignty, the right of slave ownership everywhere. The message to the North was that legally, slavery could indeed not be prevented in any Western territory, and perhaps even in the free states themselves. Some Republicans openly anticipated now a second Dred Scott decision doing just that, making slave property inviolable in the entire United States. On the day after Taney's announcement, African Americans, free or enslaved, lived in the land of the Dred Scott decision, in the country that now declared from its highest councils that black people had no future as citizens in the United States. In the wake of Dred Scott, the operative emotion in northern black communities and among abolitionists was either despair or revolutionary outrage. It quickly caused a revival of emigrationist fervor and divisive debate among black leaders trying to imagine a secure future. And it revived open contemplation of violent resistance. In May 1857, Douglass delivered a major address, the Dred Scott decision, in New York as well as other venues in the coming summer. The long speech is a remarkably tortured illustration of his efforts to perform his self-styled duty of hope in the face of the thunderous rejection handed down by the American nation. "The court's decision," said Douglass, "was a vile and shocking abomination. Though it seemed that the omens are all against us, and ultimate emancipation merely a wild, delusive idea, he promised to signal signs of encouragement." Douglass drew from his most fundamental sources of history, spirit, and philosophy, from the natural rights tradition and a biblical sense of long-term faith that providence would still guide their cause toward justice. This was, however, a tough sell in 1857. He first had to lay down the status of woe and gloom by embodying the despair, "I own myself, not insensible to the many difficulties and discouragements that beset us on every hand. They fling their broad and gloomy shadows across the pathway of every thoughtful colored man in this country." Douglass captured the horrible uncertainties of the moment. "I see them clearly and feel them sadly. With an earnest, aching heart, I have long looked for the realization of the hope of my people. And looking out upon the boundless sea of the future, I have sought in my humble way to penetrate the intervening mists and clouds, and perchance to descry in the dim and shadowy distance the white flag of freedom, the precise speck of time at which the long entombed millions rise from the foul grave of slavery and death." Personal and group pain had to be named and expressed before any new resolve could be imagined. Douglass thus gave Taney and the nation an answer as lyrical as it was terrible. "But of that time, I can know nothing, and you can know nothing. All is uncertain at this point." As usual, Douglass then shifted key and appealed to God and nature, to the old stories and old faiths. Where else could he go? "David, you know," pleaded Douglass, "looked small and insignificant when going to meet Goliath, but looked larger when he had slain his foe." He took heart that anti-slavery had transformed into its new political mode. He reminded his auditors that every compromise on slavery extension had purported to settle the question, but had never succeeded. "The fact is, the more the question has been settled, the more it has needed settling." Above all, Douglass turned to higher law doctrine. The Supreme Court of the United States is not the only power in the world, Douglas fervently declared, but the Supreme Court of the Almighty is greater. Tawney could not change the essential nature of things, making evil good and good evil. Repeatedly, Douglas invoked the law of nature and of God's imminent actions. The speech became a kind of political prayer delivered by a prophet summoning God to the aid of history. In Douglas's view, God and history were merely keeping the nation awake as the slave power advanced too far, poisoning, corrupting the institutions of the country, readying the people for the lightning, whirlwind, and earthquake to come. He grasped hope from a dreadful narrative of cataclysm and woe. Douglas's speech fell at times into a frustrating vagueness, with appeals to keep faith in the tendencies of the age. But stunningly, he ended the address with open advocacy of violence, an entreaty for all to remember that the slaves might at any time rise in insurrection. Most strikingly, he recited two verses of his own poem, The Tyrant's Jubilee, a long, remarkable work he had published in his paper in January 1857. The fire thus kindled may be revived again. The flames are extinguished, but the embers remain. One terrible blast may produce an ignition, which shall wrap the whole South in wild conflagration. The pathway of tyrants lies over volcanoes. The very air they breathe is heavy with sorrows. Agonizing heartthrobs convulse them while sleeping, and the wind whispers death as over them sweeping. Slavery was doomed, Douglas assured his audiences. Of that he was morally certain. But he stood ready to expect emancipation by fair means or foul means, in quiet or in tumult, in peace or in blood. Prophets must say what they see, however dreadful and uncertain. Within 8 months of his Dred Scott speech, Douglas and his family hosted for 3 weeks at their Rochester house a guest who would fulfill and trouble Douglas's prophecy. Chapter 15. John Brown could die for the slave. John Brown's raid upon Harper's Ferry was all his own. His zeal in the cause of freedom was infinitely superior to mine. Mine was as the taper light. His was as the burning sun. I could speak for the slave. John Brown could fight for the slave. I could live for the slave. John Brown could die for the slave. Frederick Douglass, Harper's Ferry, 1881. John Brown was charismatic, inspiring, confounding, courageous, mysterious, intimidating, given to religious zealotry, and even at times a bit boring. But he and his deeds were unforgettable. Before Frederick Douglass first met Brown in 1847, or possibly early 1848, in Springfield, Massachusetts, Douglass had heard about him, especially from other black abolitionists, who, when speaking of him, their voices would lower to a whisper. A touch of legend, creatively crafted in life and times, infused Douglass's extraordinary remembrance of his relationship with the leader of the Harper's Ferry raid. In real time, Douglass's first recorded description of Brown, written in the North Star in February 1848, after returning from a lecture tour, conforms to later remembrances. Brown was among the key people Douglass met in Springfield after delivering a lecture that the local paper deemed objectionable, because the former fugitive had stigmatized the whole country as a slave-hunting community. Whether Brown attended the lecture is not clear, but in what Douglass called a private interview, Brown left a lasting impression on Douglass. "Mr. Brown is one of the most earnest and interesting men that I have met," said the orator. Although white, Brown came across in sympathy a black man and is deeply interested in our cause, as though his own soul had been pierced with the iron of slavery. Brown ran a wool business in Springfield out of a large store and warehouse, one of many such enterprises as a merchant, a tanner, and a farmer that he launched over 3 decades, almost all of which failed and left his huge family poor. During this first encounter, Douglas spent the night with Brown's family in what Douglas remembered as their Spartan house. So large and controversial had Brown grown in national memory that in his recollection in Life and Times, Douglas strove for unusual detail. He remembered the simple ingredients served at dinner. The walls, innocent of paint, the table, unmistakably of pine and the plainest workmanship. Everything about John Brown and his house reflected, said Douglas, the stern truth, solid purpose, and rigid economy of the man. Brown fulfilled St. Paul's idea of the head of the family, Douglas observed, his wife and children treating him with reverence. As though fashioning the precise characteristics of a fictional character, Douglas described Brown's facial features, his hair, his height and weight, even the color of his eyes, which in conversation were full of light and fire. Brown walked with a long, springing racehorse step, absorbed by his own reflections. Here, rising out from the whispers, Douglas announced, was Captain John Brown, one of the most marked characters and greatest heroes known to American fame. But a great deal of troubled reality lay beneath Douglas's literary reinvention of 1881. The 12-year relationship between Douglas and Brown is one good lens through which to view both men. During the 1850s, as Douglas moved toward at least open support of violent means, the two abolitionists spent many hours and days in each other's company. As Douglas came within John Brown's orbit of religious fervor and theories of violent resistance, Douglas listened even as he was sometimes repelled. Born in Torrington, Connecticut, in 1800, Brown grew up primarily on the Western Reserve in Hudson, Ohio. His father, Owen, bestowed a staunch Calvinism in his son. Brown's memories of childhood were layered with dislocation and loss, especially that of his mother, who died when the boy was only 8. His father married 3 times and sired 16 children, a pattern John eventually more than matched with 2 wives and 20 children, many of whom did not reach adulthood. In John's youth, the Browns' household in Ohio funneled fugitive slaves onto liberty in the region or in Canada. Owen was a devout Christian abolitionist. By the time Douglas and John Brown met, and for the duration of their relationship, among the sensibilities and experiences that they shared were a relative lack of formal education, the humiliations and necessities of begging for money, an Atlantic crossing to Liverpool on the Cambria at separate times, a Bible-inspired sense that history could undergo apocalyptic change, and a passionate hatred of slavery as a system at war with humanity. At that first meeting in Springfield, Brown and Douglas conversed long into the night at a table in candlelight. Brown unfolded a large map of the United States and pointed to the Alleghenies. These mountains, Douglas recalled Brown asserting, are the basis of my plan. God has given the strength of the hills to freedom. They were placed here for the emancipation of the Negro race. For many years to come, decoding just what the elements of Brown's plan were became a beguiling preoccupation for Douglas and others. On that night in Springfield, he was enthralled, but skeptical. He never claimed to know with any certainty the purpose of the Virginia Mountains, morally or geologically. Brown, however, imagined them full of natural forts and good hiding places. Beginning with only 25 trained men, he would run off the slaves in large numbers in at least one Virginia county. Somehow in these mountain hideaways, they would fight off the inevitable force that would assemble in counterattack, and many of the local slaves would join their force. The true object, Douglas gleaned, seemed to be destroying the money value of slave property. That aim Douglas understood. But then he pushed back with questions Brown could answer only in moralistic, not strategic, terms. How would he support his men? Douglas asked. What would Brown do when surrounded by the bloodhounds of the slave power's police state when roused? Brown thought he could whip them. But if he could not, and was killed in such guerrilla action, he had no better use for his life than to lay it down in the cause of the slave. In this reinvented conversation, Douglas expressed a harsh truth about Brown. The old warrior worked passionately for years on a plan that, in the end, may have represented a personal desire to sacrifice for the slaves more than a genuine strategy for revolution. In these years, Douglas looked anxiously for a logic in violence. The problem with Brown was that he could never be completely squared with rationality. But as we have seen, in the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act or Dred Scott, logic was no longer the weapon of choice for a radical abolitionist. Douglas admitted that the more contact he had with Brown, my utterances became more and more tinged by the color of this man's strong impressions. Douglas and Brown continued to correspond through the early 1850s, and they eventually met on many more occasions. At least as early as 1851, the two exchanged letters, making sure Brown received Douglas's paper. And in 1854, after Brown had moved to Akron, Ohio, he wrote an extraordinary epistle to Douglas in the voice of an Old Testament prophet chastising the evils of American leaders and their poisoned institutions. It was as though Brown wanted to join Douglas in condemning the slave power, but to do so with even more biblical rage. Worried about the fate of the American Republic, Brown had no doubt about what stood in its path. The pro-slavery extreme wickedness of political and religious leadership at all levels, even the marshals, sheriffs, constables, and policemen. We do not have Douglas's direct response to this letter, but what he read in Brown's condemnations of American perfidy was a denunciation, even beyond higher law doctrine, that left only violence as an option. American leadership was taking the country into anarchy in all its horrid forms, Brown argued. Therefore, he had a ready answer. What punishment ever inflicted by man, or even threaded by God, can be too severe for those whose influence is 1,000 times more malignant than the atmosphere of the deadly Upas, for those who hate the right and the Most High? To Brown, God governs the universe and its man-made nations. Hence the only alternative for the righteous was to destroy such fiends clothed in human form. Brown trusted Douglas's knowledge of Scripture as he poured forth passages from the Old and New Testaments. To a degree, Brown and Douglas shared a biblical grounding. The real laws of the United States, for Brown, were God's commands. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped. Thou shalt not oppress him. He recited from Deuteronomy in his letter to Douglas. From Matthew, Brown revisited the famous command, Therefore all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. And in Nehemiah, he found his indictment of rulers who had forsaken God's law. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood. Nehemiah had smote and cleansed, when necessary, the wayward Israelites. As Brown wrote to Douglas in early 1854, even before the Kansas-Nebraska Act, Brown seemed lonely and mired in a deep Christian despair over the abominably wicked laws of the country. But he fully expected a reckoning to come. I am too destitute of words to express the tithe of what I feel, Brown concluded, as he begged Douglas to convey his appeal in suitable language to a larger world. By and large, Douglas did just that. He admired and used the Hebrew prophets, and Brown not only looked and talked like one, he seemed willing to challenge or destroy the wicked Jerusalem. In Life and Times, Douglas confessed that he never felt in the presence of a stronger religious influence than in the company of John Brown. Although Douglas honored human law more, perhaps the sensibility that he and Brown shared most in the long run was a millennial and apocalyptic sense of history, drawn from the old stories of the prophets and from the zeitgeist of antebellum America. In that era, millennialist thought was a cluster of religious and secular ideas forged into a kind of national creed. In its more hopeful mode, it held that Christ would have a second coming in the New Israel of America, or at least that the country possessed a mission as a redeemer nation, destined to perform a special role in history. Millennialism was an outlook on history, a disposition about human nature, a belief that America was a place where mankind had been given a second chance, and above all, that God governed history and chose the moments of transformation. A nation of Protestants could interpret events as steps in its providential destiny. The darker side of millennialism exposed the burden of chosenness, an eschatological expectation of God's wrath and destruction meant that people must constantly prepare for a break in time and new beginnings. Both Douglas and Brown shared this vision. Sterner and bleaker, Brown's millennialism manifested in daily devotions and instructions to his children. Brown's son, Salmon, remembered his father's strict Sabbath observance. Sunday evenings he would gather the family and hired help and have the Ten Commandments and the Catechism repeated. Sometimes he would preach a regular sermon. Besides, we had prayers morning and night of every day, with Bible reading, all standing during prayer, Father himself leaning on a chair, upreared on the forward legs, the old-fashioned Presbyterian way. Brown's faith was rooted in a deeply personal concern about sin, his own and that of others, especially his children. "He constantly expostulated with us," said Salmon, "and in letters went away. His expressed hope was that ye sin not, that you form no foolish attachments, that you be not a companion to fools." Brown was often hardest on himself, on his own profound need for atonement. His record of business failures, his struggle to provide meager sustenance to his brood as he lost more than one farm, and his imprisonment for debt in the wake of the Panic of 1837, left him many inner demons. Writing to all his children in late 1852, he worried that they had lost the faith he had instilled in them, even as he blamed himself. He admitted to little, very little, to cheer, and hoped that his family may understand that this world is not the home of man. He urged his sons and daughters not to reflect on how their father had wandered from the road, but to pray to God for their own thorough conversion from sin, and to stay steadfast in his ways through the very short season of trial you will have to pass. In the midst of such religious affliction, Brown ended the letter, worried about whether the family could afford to pay for Douglas paper. In a remarkable letter to his eldest son, John Jr., in 1853, Brown expressed pain and sorrow at the young man's loss of faith. Then John Sr. drew upon passages from the first five books of the Old Testament to warn his erring son with the words of Moses, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, and Samuel, not to fall into the same disposition in Israel to backslide. Brown's sons were devoted abolitionists. They followed their father for their own reasons, perhaps least of all because he had used Joshua to instruct them. John Jr. later experienced a mental breakdown in Kansas in 1856, captured, beaten, and imprisoned after fighting as a guerrilla warrior at his father's side. Another son, Frederick, was killed in the Kansas War. John Brown's personal holy war on slavery became an extended family disaster. Douglas, on the other hand, was a father deeply concerned with his children's literacy and education, but we do not know as much about his concern for their religious temperaments. He seems to have worried more about their writing skills than their faith. "I know this is not as good writing as you would like to see," wrote his 15-year-old son Charles in 1860, "but I am in haste, so good night." In these years, Douglas's millennialism and his religious faith were a set of root values layered throughout his oratory and his writing. He arrived at his spiritual understanding of history through his lifelong informal theological means, reading the Bible and a good deal of history, and especially by his years of rhetorical engagement on abolitionist platforms, listening to and arguing with Garrison, Phillips, Gerrit Smith, McCune Smith, Raymond, Delaney, Abby Kelly, and others. Douglas's millennialism was forward-looking and activist, waiting for the jubilee of black emancipation, and the fulfillment of America's national destiny required patience, but also struggle. It demanded faith and suffering. Douglass played the prophetic role of the suffering servant with zeal. His famous statement about agitation, delivered in a speech in 1857, has stood the test of time and numerous protest ideologies. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Those were what McCune Smith had called Douglass's workable, doable words for the ages. In his analysis of the slave power, Douglass accepted political and moral loss as the price of an inevitable progress. Sometimes his rhetoric could seem driven by a vague moral determinism. The enemies, slavery and freedom, were irreconcilable, he wrote in 1855. But freedom must triumph because it had the laws which governed the moral universe on its side. A collision between these two enemy forces must come, Douglass maintained, as sure as the laws of God cannot be trampled upon with impunity. Millennialists had a peculiarly persistent need for that word, must. It kept them moving through the thickets of uncertainty. But for Douglass, millennial symbolism was not merely a rhetorical device to sustain collective hope. It was a real source of faith. He wanted his 1,000 black listeners to see a celebration of the American Jubilee, Douglass declared in Canandaigua, New York, in 1857. That jubilee will come. You and I may not live to see it, but God reigns, and slavery must yet fall, unless the devil is more potent than the Almighty. Unless sin is stronger than righteousness, slavery must perish. History possessed a trajectory not easily discerned. There was something godlike in the British decree of emancipation in the West Indies in the 1830s. Douglass proclaimed. He knew that British emancipation was more complex than spiritual imagery alone could convey, but he could not resist calling the event a wondrous transformation and a bolt from the moral sky. He called on African Americans to see West Indian emancipation as a city upon a hill to light the way toward their own new history. Such faith was difficult to sustain after the Dred Scott decision. In a letter to a Scottish anti-slavery society, with which Julia Griffiths now worked to raise money for Douglass's paper, the editor acknowledged dark portents hanging over the abolitionist cause. Then he gave his correspondent a good dose of millennial medicine. "I am now at work less under the influences or inspiration of hope than the settled assurances of faith in God and the ultimate triumph of righteousness in the world. The cause of the slaves is a righteous and humane one. Though long delayed, it will triumph at last." Torn at times between warring options, Douglass knew he must travel by faith as much as by sight. But he would also have his fellow blacks see and act as well as believe in their path to liberation. And thus, perhaps, his sustained interest in Brown's revolutionary schemes. Emancipation in the British Empire gave Douglass a grand historical precedent and a reason to issue a call to arms in his own country. Americans were good at fast days and 4th of Julys, Douglass said, but their sequel never showed anything but men whose hearts are crammed with arrogancy, pride, and hate. Then, characteristically, Douglass found his firm footing and his story in Isaiah 58. "We have bowed down our heads as a bulrush, and have spread sackcloth and ashes under us." Isaiah had warned so poignantly against false fasting. "The house of Jacob fasted, but in the end seest not, and takest no knowledge." In his own best King James language, Douglas argued just the same for Americans who could not or would not learn from the past. British emancipation had been an act, he believed, not about commerce, but conscience, a spiritual triumph and a product of the soul. Rewriting Isaiah nearly word for word for a new century and place, Douglas declared his countrymen incapable of what the British had created. A chosen fast of the living God, a day in which the bands of wickedness were loosed, the heavy burdens undone, the oppressed let go free, every yoke broken, the poor that were cast out of the house brought in, and men no longer hiding themselves from their own flesh. Instead, Americans were just so many marsh plants sagging over silently in the swamp. To Douglas, though, history was both warning and inspiration. He also used the model of West Indian emancipation to remind audiences that Jamaican slaves had rebelled many times on their road to a parliamentary edict of their freedom. He reminded his black audience in upstate New York of McCune Smith's overt plea in 1856 that they, blacks, not wait for liberty to be given, as in the British Empire, and instead celebrate their own heroes, such as Denmark Vesey and Nat Turner. As he so often did in the 1850s, Douglas quoted the passage from Byron's Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. Who would be free themselves must strike the first blow. Then, rather stunningly, he reminded his auditors of the black heroes who had risked death rather than endure slavery. Margaret Garner's infanticide, Madison Washington of the Creole Shipboard Rebellion, Parker and the Christiana rioters, Joseph Kincaid of the Amistad Mutiny. Douglas stressed how much insurrection had ultimately influenced British colonial planters to accept abolition, and awakened the guilty fears of white Southerners when General Nat Turner kindled the fires of insurrection in Southampton. Douglas was ready to probe the dark, rebellious disposition of the slaves, if only he could find someone with a plan he could trust. During the decade before Harper's Ferry, Douglas sustained an abiding interest in aiding Brown's crusade, less perhaps on strategic grounds than because of the white radicals' demonstrable commitment to racial equality. Although their temperaments differed markedly, their face-to-face encounters, correspondence, and shared interest in the possibilities of violence sustained a friendship. Many black abolitionists would eventually honor Brown's racial openness after he died a martyr's death. At the heart of his immediate legacy, after all, was the idea that he was the white man who died to set black people free. In 1848, shortly after his first meeting with Douglas, Brown published a satirical essay, Sambo's Mistakes, in the black newspaper Ram's Horn. Written in the voice of a black man who needs to confess his misdeeds of apathy, materialism, and sloth, the piece invoked many stereotypes about northern free blacks. Instead of taking advantage of education, this Sambo spent his time devouring silly novels and other miserable trash. Instead of saving money to buy a good farm, he preferred chewing and smoking tobacco. Rather than attaining character and influence among men, this ne'er-do-well was obliged to travel about in search of employment as a hostler, shoeblack, and fiddler. He could never practice self-denial and loved his chains, finger rings, breastpins. And worst, he confessed to failing as a citizen, a husband, a father, a brother, a neighbor. Witty but bizarre, this awkwardly written essay demonstrated not only a puritanical obsession with the foibles of others, but a direct attack on the lack of self-reliance among blacks. It could be read as misguided racial paternalism, as ironic self-revelatory guilt, or as a righteous chastisement of a disorganized black community that needed upbraiding. With McCune Smith, Douglas had long demanded greater black self-improvement initiatives and felt frustrated by an apathy he found among free blacks. He could stand the insults and slanders of the known haters of his people. He welcomed them as a natural incident of the war. But what exasperated him was the listless indifference hanging over so many struggling blacks who should be all on fire. Hence, not only was Douglas impressed with Brown's egalitarianism, but with his direct efforts to help raise black aspirations. In 1846, Gerrit Smith purchased a huge tract of 120,000 acres of land in upstate New York with the intent of granting it to urban free blacks so they could become independent landowning farmers and thus qualify to vote under that state's suffrage law. Although the environment was harsh, some blacks took advantage of the utopian plan, and in the spring of 1849, Brown, with his wife Mary and five children, joined them in North Elba. There, Brown, for a while, devoted himself to living among these poor, despised Africans, as he put it, in settlements known as Timbuktu. Brown employed a free black man named Thomas Jefferson, as well as a fugitive slave from Florida named Cyrus. Blacks often took meals with the Browns at their farmhouse. Though as poor as the winters were cold, Brown dispensed occasional barrels of pork and flour to his neighbors, as well as a good deal of advice about religion, personal conduct, and resistance to the Fugitive Slave Act. Douglas was amply aware of Brown's anti-racist venture in North Elba. Gerrit Smith had granted the Rochesterite a piece of land, which he never occupied, and did the same for most other black abolitionists. This kind of pioneering agricultural activism was never Douglas's fear, but he eagerly welcomed Smith's uplift philanthropy among blacks. The sentiments of Sambo's mistakes appeared in many of Douglas's editorials and speeches, some of which Brown read in the former slave's paper. Whether from the backbreaking exertions of farmers on that mountain terrain of North Elba, or the literary and organizational leadership of black intellectuals, Douglas believed, as he stated in 1855, that every day brings evidence that our elevation as a race is almost wholly dependent upon our own exertions. If we are ever elevated, our elevation will be accomplished through our own instrumentality. He eagerly wanted blacks to take their fate into their own hands. Nothing is more humiliating, Douglas smugly declared in 1857, than his own people's apathy. He could only be moved and glad that a Gerrit Smith and a John Brown wished so sincerely to lend their lives to the quest for equality. But blacks could not wait for their white patrons. To black audiences, Douglas could preach as stern a brand of conservative self-improvement as any black voice of his era. In rhetorical moves representative of a brand of black nationalism, Douglas often turned attacks on white racism into angry rebukes of black lethargy. In an 1855 speech at Shiloh Presbyterian Church in New York to a mixed audience, Douglas, with McCune Smith chairing the meeting, wondered aloud about how difficult it was to address certain sensitive issues among blacks in front of whites. Blacks, Douglas said, too often provided a spectacle for all the world to watch in its desire to measure the heights of civilization. Douglas admitted that the larger world constantly asked, are blacks like other men? Could the Negro do without a master? Can he rise from ignorance to intelligence, or disorder to order? These questions could not be answered by the white race. They were peculiarly the duties of the colored people. And blacks' doubt among ourselves stood in the way and caused Douglas, he confessed, to blush and fall into gloomy thoughts. His people must show them, whites, by becoming skillful architects, profound thinkers, originators and discoverers of ideas. They must produce their own Webster, Clay, and Calhoun. Then, as Douglas marched through this stern message, a group of colored gals walked into the sanctuary, distracting and annoying the orator, who stopped to upbraid them for not being punctual. Regaining his composure, Douglas gave a vigorous appeal for violent resistance to slave catchers. Fear inculcates respect, he proclaimed. I would rather see insurrection for the next 6 months in the South than that slavery should exist there for the next 6 years. He left his Shiloh audience laughing with jokes about how whites automatically think of blacks as drunk or lazy, and ended by singing an abolition ballad to the tune of I'll Never Get Drunk Again. Brown would have wholeheartedly agreed with every gesture, except possibly the jokes. Similarly, 3 years later, at the same church, but to a largely black audience gathered to protest historic discrimination on the Sixth Avenue Railroad in New York, Douglass blasted the spirit of caste that robbed his people of every kind of civil right. But worst of all, now 1 year in the wake of Dred Scott, he feared that the emancipated colored man risked having burned into his very soul the brand of inferiority. He openly worried in front of his fellow blacks that an impression had settled upon them, implying that we ourselves are unconcerned and even contented with our condition. Douglass confronted his auditors harshly. I detest the slaveholder and almost equally detest a contented slave. They are both enemies of freedom. With no jokes to soothe the message, he left the 1858 protest rally with the warning that oppression deadens sensibility in its victims. The only recourse was to sustain faith not in law, but in ourselves. Such fierce appeals for self-reliance, mixed with demands for violent resistance in the late 1850s, made for a potent, if toxic, brew of confusion, rage, and bloodlust. As Douglass tried to find firm footing with these issues and with his emerging relationship with Brown, another kind of confusion walked forthrightly into his life. Seeking permission to translate and publish My Bondage and My Freedom in German, Ottilie Assing first came to visit Douglass in Rochester in the summer of 1856. Born in 1819 in Hamburg to a physician-poet father and a mother who was a teacher and romantic poet, Assing had veered from one kind of idealistic and romantic cause to another, until, in personal frustration and desperate for independence, she moved to America in 1852 to pursue a new career as a journalist. Emotionally volatile, the survivor of at least one suicide attempt with a dagger she took to her chest when she was 23, a free-thinking atheist, and a devotee of Alexander von Humboldt's ideas about human equality, Assing soon saw that the most compelling issues in her adopted America were race and slavery. As a German romantic, she was always in search of the hero in history, the maker of new nations, new ideas, and new times. By attending anti-slavery meetings in New York after she took up residence among other German emigres across the Hudson in New Jersey, Assing began to discover candidates for her ideal hero. First, there was Wendell Phillips, whom she saw speak and found enthralling at the annual gathering of the American Anti-Slavery Society in 1854. Then for a while she became fascinated with James Pennington, the minister of Shiloh Presbyterian Church in New York. Assing wrote a long, unwieldy essay on the black preacher and translated some of his narrative, The Fugitive Blacksmith, until she lost interest, possibly because of a fundamental distaste for religion and the black church. The only account we have of Assing and Douglass's first meeting is Assing's own, which, in her breathless style, she self-servingly included in her introduction to the German edition of Bondage and Freedom. She must have come to Rochester all but unannounced, since she first stopped at the office of the North Star, only to discover that the editor was still at home. As a fellow journalist, she had come to interview Douglass. So as directed, Assing walked the more than 2 miles to South Avenue to find the editor's homestead. She found a handsome villa, surrounded by a large garden, situated on a hill overlooking a charming landscape. But she reserved most of her Vorrede zu Sklaverei und Freiheit, the German title of Douglass's book, for sensuous physical descriptions of Douglass, as well as a spectacular tribute to his skills as an orator. Employing the words brilliant or brilliance 3 times in 2 sentences, Assing's Douglass possessed perfect mastery of language and the most mellifluous, sonorous, flexible voice speaking to the heart as I have ever heard. His very name filled American halls to overflowing, she maintained, as if a new apostle had revealed to them for the first time a truth that had lain unspoken in everyone's heart. Assing identified Douglass as a light mulatto of unusually tall, slender, and powerful stature. His features are striking, she gushed. The prominently domed forehead with a peculiarly deep cleft at the base of the nose, an aquiline nose, and the narrow, beautifully carved lips betray more of his white than his black origin. The thick hair, here and there with touches of gray, is frizzy and unruly, but not woolly. Having dispensed with these common 19th-century racialized depictions, Ossing made it clear she had found a romantic hero for the age. Douglas's whole appearance, stamped by past storms and struggles, bespeaks great energy and willpower that shuns no obstacle in the face of all odds. She observed briefly their wide-ranging conversation, then, in a telling non sequitur, acknowledged bluntly that she met the family. Douglas's wife is completely black, and his 5 children, therefore, have more of the traits of the Negro than he. The family, especially the children, would get to know Ossing as friend, intruder, and benefactor. The German journalist, with her powers of observation, had found her Siegfried ready to go slay the American dragons. Ossing's attraction to Douglas was permanent, and she would do her best as a propagandist, at least for German audiences, to shape the Rochester editor's reputation in relation to John Brown. The saga of how Douglas and Brown forged an important, if tragic, alliance publicly commenced at the inaugural convention of the Radical Abolition Party in Syracuse, New York, June 26th to 28th, 1855. By then, 5 of Brown's sons, led by John Jr., whose farm in Ohio was failing from drought and debt, had moved to Kansas. That territory had become the feverish test case of the doctrine of popular sovereignty laid out in the fateful Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. Flocks of pro-slavery and free soil settlers were moving into the land west of Missouri, and the region teetered on the brink of guerrilla war. Brown praised his sons for their commitment to go to Kansas with a view to help defeat Satan and his legions. The father was still committed to his work among blacks in North Alba. But by the spring of 1855, John Jr. wrote from his farm near Osawatomie that every slaveholding state is furnishing men and money to fasten slavery upon this glorious land by means no matter how foul. When his father trekked over hill and dale for 150 miles to get to Syracuse for the convention of the only political party Brown may have ever joined, Kansas not only fired his imagination, but that of the nearly 300 delegates as well. The Radical Abolition Party lasted a mere 5 years. At the 1855 gathering, McCune Smith chaired the proceedings, which Douglas especially celebrated as something to which black people could ever proudly refer. Gerrit Smith was in his glory as the primary host and funder of the proceeding, and the convention spent a great deal of time debating and justifying what Douglas referred to as the iron-linked logic of the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution. Most important, the convention's delegates from 10 states and Canada passed a resolution affirming the use of violence to overthrow slavery. Brown was exhilarated by the convention. According to Douglas, Brown presented the case for his own decision and that of his sons to go to Kansas and fight for the free state cause. Brown quoted from Hebrews as he also appealed for money. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. Gerrit Smith read 2 letters aloud to the assembled body from Brown's sons to their father, which only the proud patriarch could have provided. In 1 letter, they advised the abolitionists to thoroughly arm and organize themselves as they begged for revolvers, rifles, and bowie knives, which they needed more than bread. This gathering exuded a radical, biblical militancy not yet seen in formal political abolitionism. McCune Smith used the term Bible politics to describe the party's point of view and called its platform a Jubilee doctrine more important than the diffusion of the principle of science. The biracial throng of abolitionists, the physician announced, would go hence to proclaim the gospel of liberty, for it is the good news, glad tidings of great joy, that we have to tell. Douglas seems to have left Syracuse inspired as well. In his paper, he especially reported on the sweet abolition songs at the Radicals' convention. As well as that, one delegate had been a fugitive slave who had been obliged to avail himself of the Underground Railroad in order to participate, and was now safely residing in Canada. But above all, Douglas said that he and his comrades at Syracuse were fed up with the idea of limiting slavery and hoping that it may die out. He said he now belonged to a party that would lay the axe to the tree with a single demand, that it was the right, the power, and the duty of the federal government to abolish slavery in every state in the American Union. Behind the scenes in Syracuse, he had conversations with Brown and helped raise money for his cause. The two would not meet again until late 1856, after the intriguing radical had carved out a bloody history in Kansas and launched a conspiracy to attack slavery in the South, with which Douglas became deeply entwined. No one who knew John Brown ever doubted his bravery, his passion, or that he believed he was living and dying as an agent in God's plan. He went to Kansas in the fall of 1855 to make war on slavery. As Douglas published and promoted Bondage and Freedom that autumn, Brown, accompanied by his teenage son Oliver and a son-in-law, Henry Thompson, traveled west to eastern Kansas primarily by walking, but also with a horse and a wagon full of weapons. There, with parts of his extended family, including women and children, living in tents and shanties, the 55-year-old, soon called Captain Brown, led a band of warriors among the Free State forces in what soon became Bleeding Kansas. Kansas was a brutal physical and political environment. Members of Brown's clan suffered frostbite and near starvation during the winter of 1855 to 56, and by that spring, the numerous murders and depredations by pro-slavery border ruffians from Missouri signaled the wider bloodshed to follow. In May 1856, after pro-slavery bands attacked and burned Lawrence, Kansas, the free soil bastion of the territory, Brown snapped with rage. In retaliation, and against the wishes of some of his sons, Brown orchestrated a bloody middle-of-the-night raid on three pro-slavery dwellings along Pottawatomie Creek, resulting in the savage murder of five men. The victims, all non-slaveholders, but supporters of the slave state cause, were seized from the clutches of their families, taken a couple hundred yards from their cabins, and slashed to death and mutilated with broadswords. At least two were also shot in the face or chest, likely after they were already dead. The Pottawatomie Massacre would forever be part of John Brown's legacy, an uncomfortable challenge to his sympathetic biographers, but ample evidence to those who take a clear-eyed look at how old Brown understood the uses and meaning of terror. Brown planned and ordered the murders, and though he may not have actually committed the slashings, he may have fired the gun. Back east, among his abolitionist supporters and funders, the facts about Pottawatomie remained for the ensuing 3 years a matter of willful mystery and avoidance, as well as part of a legend that the old warrior now cultivated about himself in the service of broader schemes. In December 1856, as Brown was traveling eastward to raise money and men, he stopped in Rochester and took dinner at Douglas's house. Little is known of what they discussed that evening, but in the next 2 years, their collaboration deepened as Brown repeatedly tried to recruit Douglas to the cause of fomenting a slave uprising in Virginia. Possibly they discussed Brown's long-standing interest in military history, slave revolts, and maroon colonies, as well as some details of the Kansas bloodshed. Whether Brown divulged the reality of Pottawatomie is doubtful, although the idea of slaveholders' blood on Brown's coat, whether fresh from the Battle of Osawatomie or from a preemptive primal killing in the dark of night, would only have inspired Douglas. But by the time he wrote about Brown with long retrospect in 1881, Douglas knew and approved of what had happened in Kansas. By then, Brown was the mythic hero whose hour had come. Old Osawatomie Brown had merely met persecution with persecution, and house burning with signal and terrible retaliation. In Life and Times, Douglas harbored no hesitation in defending Brown's deeds and methods, and likewise, in 1857, it is not likely he did either. The horrors wrought by his iron hand, Douglas wrote, cannot be contemplated without a shudder, but it is the shudder which one feels at the execution of a murderer. Necessity is the full justification of it to reason. His problem with the old man was strategic, not ethical, although Douglas continually struggled to square killing with reason. Above all, Brown needed money. Throughout most of 1857, he traveled across the North, fashioning Kansas as a moral crusade and enlisting some of the most prominent abolitionists in his effort. In March, in Worcester, Massachusetts, Brown was a platform guest as Douglas gave a speech. But Brown's fundraising efforts floundered as the economic panic of 1857 swept across the country. Staying with abolitionist allies, Brown wrote numerous letters in which he appealed to the New England anti-slavery conscience, as well as for his destitute family and band of soldiers. He made many important connections with abolitionists who were convinced that the Kansas Free State cause demanded their moral and financial support. Gradually, Brown managed a tempestuous alliance with a Secret Six group of activists, including Samuel Gridley Howe, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, Franklin Sanborn, Theodore Parker, Gerrit Smith, and especially George Luther Stearns, a self-made magnate enriched by linseed oil and lead pipe manufacturing, who, after his wife received Brown's appeal, pledged thousands of dollars. All in their own ways were attracted to Brown as a romantic warrior hero who would take the anti-slavery cause to the field of battle as none of them could. Like many of his fellow abolitionists, Douglas no longer had to imagine or invent a John Brown. He showed up at Douglas's doorstep, hat in hand, but also again with maps, plans, and half-told tales. In the last week of January, 1858, Brown arrived in Rochester and became a boarder with Douglas's family at $3 per week for 3 weeks. From this and other encounters, Douglas became as well informed of Brown's ultimate aims as any abolitionist or accomplice outside of his small personal band. From upstairs at Douglas's house and in secrecy using the alias N. Nelson Hawkins, Brown carried on a near daily correspondence with his family and with potential supporters and donors. To Higginson, Gerrit Smith, Sanborn, and Stearns, he wrote cryptically of his railroad business of a somewhat extended scale, as he asked for money to accomplish his clandestine work. As the letters flowed in and out of the house, with 13-year-old Charles Douglas as the carrier to and from the post office, Douglas learned intimately of Brown's plan of running off slaves by establishing safe locations in the mountains of Virginia. Such a scheme for rendering slave property in Maryland and Virginia valueless and insecure, intrigued Douglas, who recalled his own desperation for any new mode of attack on slavery. Also while staying with the Douglases and eating at Anna's table, Brown drafted his Provisional Constitution, which he intended to put in place as an interim government in Virginia if his invasion succeeded. Just how much Brown and Douglas debated political philosophy and constitutionalism is unknown. But Douglas kept a personal copy of the Constitution with its 48 articles, which together provided a bold, if redundant, blueprint, first for revolution, and then for order to control anarchy and chaos in wartime. Above all, Douglas surely agreed wholeheartedly with Brown's preamble, much of which could have been lifted from the editorials and speeches written by the host. The provisional government would be established in the name of the proscribed, oppressed, and enslaved citizens of the United States. Slavery, proclaimed the document's first line, is none other than a most barbarous, unprovoked, and unjustifiable war of one portion of its citizens upon another portion, the only conditions of which are perpetual imprisonment and hopeless servitude, or absolute extermination. Brown wrote the document to present to a convention in Chatham, Canada, that he would convene in May 1858, as a means of recruiting among the substantial free black and fugitive community in that region of Western Ontario. That convention did eventually attract 34 black and 12 white delegates.